Good afternoon. My name is Ellen Aitken, and I am the Dean of McGill's Faculty of Religious Studies. I am delighted, deeply pleased, to see you all here this afternoon for the launch of the McGill Initiative in the World's Religions and Globalization. Today, we have the immense privilege of marking our university's partnership with the Tony Blair Faith Foundation's Faith in Globalization Initiative in the company of the Right Honorable Tony Blair. To get the proceedings started, I would like to call upon our Principal and Vice Chancellor, Heather Monroe Bloom, to say a few words. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dean Aitken. Bonjour et bienvenue, chers collègues, étudiants, invités distingués. What a great honor it is for us at McGill to have you here, Mr. Blair. It is just tremendous, and to be able in your presence and with you to partner in this great new initiative. I'd like to recognize, in addition to the Right Honorable Tony Blair and members of the Tony Blair Faith Foundation, our members of Parliament, our British Consul General, Chair of the Board of Governors of McGill, Governors Emeriti, colleagues and friends. What a pleasure to be able to mark this moment in the history of our Faculty of Religious Studies with our distinguished guest and with the launch of this new initiative. Mr. Blair's accomplishments are well known. They'll be mentioned by Jonathan Burke shortly, and just again to say simply how pleased we are to be doing this with you. The Foundation's premise is to promote religion as a force for good, to increase interfaith awareness, and to employ these values in the mitigation of global poverty and conflict. What a mission, what a vision. And there has been no time when this mission has been more urgently important than it is today. And as Principal of McGill, I speak not just for McGill, but for the other distinguished university partners in this initiative to say how pleased we are that you've chosen universities as your partners, at least as some of your partners in undertaking this. Universities remain a place in the world where the exchange of ideas, points of views, indeed controversial ideas, can be exchanged and debated, and where we can openly work at building collegial society and global engagement to solve global problems. We're very proud of the 7 eminent global universities that are members of the Tony Blair Faith Foundation initiative to date. Among them, partners already with McGill, Yale University, Peking University, Tech Monterey, and the National University of Singapore, amongst others. And finally, before turning things back to Dean Aitken, I want to thank our patrons for the McGill Initiative, and in particular, Mr. Eugene McBurney, one of the 3 co-chairs of Campaign McGill, whose most generous gift to the Faculty of Religious Studies 1 year ago made so much of this possible. Gene, would you please stand up and be recognized? And I'd like to say as well that we're very pleased to have with us 3 other great supporters of the whole area of global engagement on public policy and communitarian issues of most current urgency. Ms. Belinda Stronach, would you please stand up, Belinda, and be recognized? Mr. Victor Davalay. Victor, would you stand up, please? And shortly, you will meet our alumnus and another great supporter, Mr. Jonathan Burke. Let me now again reintroduce Dean Ellen Aitken. You heard that soft, gentle voice when she was giving her admonitions about having your Blackberries and cell phones on. Don't let that fool you for one moment. She is a woman of great courage and determination, and bringing this program to this moment is one expression of that. We were just honored and delighted to have Ellen agree to join McGill a few years ago. Coming to us from Harvard, she's a gifted scholar of the New Testament, Early Christianity and Early Judaism. Dean Aitken holds degrees from Harvard University and the University of South. She came to McGill in 2004 and was appointed dean in 2007. And under the sterling leadership that she demonstrated from the moment she arrived, the faculty has emphasized the role of religion and the role it plays in public life and society through an expanding research framework for the faculty, through its multidisciplinary course offerings, and through its extraordinary public lecture series. It gives me great pleasure now to call again on Dean Ellen Aitken. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Principal, for those gracious words. Honored guests, Mr. Blair, colleagues, friends, and above all, students, I'm grateful to you for being here today. Today is a very exciting day for McGill and for the Faculty of Religious Studies as we formally launch our new initiative in religion and globalization and our partnership with this global network of research universities that is being brought together and coordinated by the Tony Blair Faith Foundation. The purpose of the initiative of university work and the purpose of McGill being part of that is to establish McGill as the premier site in Canada for teaching, scholarship, and research regarding the myriad dimensions of religion and the globalizing dynamics of contemporary society. In order to do this well, it requires at least three things. First, a strong foundation in the analytical and engaged study of the world's religions in historical and contemporary perspectives. Second, lively connections with colleagues and students in many other disciplines around the university, such as law, education, medicine, the environment, political science, to name only a few. And third, the global perspectives brought by partnerships with scholars and students in other regions of this world. We need one another, and we need the particular perspectives that our commitments, social locations, regional locations, and our various disciplines contribute. The Faculty of Religious Studies recognizes the crucial role played by religion and brings the highest level of academic excellence to the study and analysis of the world's religions as dimensions of human society and human life. Through our vibrant graduate programs, our professional program, and our teaching throughout the undergraduate curriculum, we shape the capacity for such understanding in students today, as we have done over the past several decades. The initiative in religion and globalization builds on the heritage of the faculty in the university, in its engagement with wider publics, and particularly on the research and teaching in globalization that has gone on in our faculty since the 1990s. Today, as we launch this initiative, I want to tell you that it is being built on four pillars. First of all, teaching, with an emphasis particularly on undergraduate teaching. This morning, a group of about 50 undergraduate students who are in this year's Religion and Globalization class were fortunate to have Mr. Blair as their guest speaker, and in fact to spend about 60 minutes in very substantive discussion on the issues that they have been studying all semester. Secondly, research. That we will develop a number of research areas, research trajectories that coordinate different activities within McGill, that connect us with other universities, particularly the other universities in the faith and globalization network. Research that is both global and at times intensely local, because all of the issues of global interaction with religions, with plural cultures and societies, often are expressed at the local level, as well as around the globe. The third pillar is our outreach to wider publics, to speak of the role of the world's religions, of religious identity, of religious communities, to general publics, and to very specific policymakers, to people who run NGOs, to teachers. And we look forward to this kind of engagement with this country and with partners throughout the world. And lastly, the fourth pillar is to make this knowledge available in various forms of publication. The title of today's conversation with Mr. Blair, Educating Innovative Leaders, Religions and the New Global Realities, recognizes that the leaders of the future, that is, all of the McGill students, need to understand the roles that religions play in relation to all the issues of geopolitical and global society. This has been the long-standing commitment of the faculty. It is the commitment of the Blair Faith Foundation, and it is the foundation of our work in this initiative. So I thank you for your support, your ideas, your presence. It heartens and encourages us in this important work. I would now like to call upon Ruth Turner, the Executive Director of the Tony Blair Faith Foundation, to speak. Ms. Turner is an award-winning social entrepreneur, and over the past 16 years, she has founded and run businesses that address issues including homelessness, healthcare, climate change, housing, media, and scientific innovation. She has worked alongside Mr. Blair since May of 2005, when she was appointed as Office's Director of Government Relations, a post she held till he resigned. And she is behind such other initiatives as the Tony Blair Sports Foundation, which she set up 3 years ago. And through her work, she has demonstrated an unwavering commitment to religious education and its ability to respond to pressing international concerns. Please join me in welcoming Ruth Turner.
Thank you very much, Heather, Ellen, Jean, distinguished guests and students, and all of those who've made it possible for us to be here today. It is a pleasure to be here, and in the last 10 days, I've seen Tony debate and discuss with students and faculty in Mexico, at Monterey Tech, at Peking University in China, at Yale yesterday in the USA, and then this morning with students at McGill. And next week, and also the week after, we will welcome new universities across the world into this debate as part of the Faith in Globalization initiative. So I just wanted to explain why, when he left office, Tony Blair said that he wanted the Faith Foundation to be a very practical organization. So why did we go first to universities to create a partnership with them, if practical was what we wanted to be? Well, it's because practice and policy has to be rooted in a deep and intellectually rigorous understanding of how the world works, of the changes the world is undergoing, and the challenges that those changes set those of us who seek peaceful coexistence between people of all faiths and none. But I also joke the other reason is that when he stood down as Prime Minister, I thought he missed those weekly grillings that he used to get of Prime Minister's questions. So we thought we'd fix for him to regularly debate with some of the cleverest students from every part of the world. But politics and society today are undergoing profound changes, and we need to not avoid issues that are difficult, but actually to welcome unsettling questions, and also to involve experts of every discipline in helping us understand and answer them. The Faith Foundation works in high schools in 15 countries across the world, and in local communities in over 100 countries. But all of this is rooted in the international network of universities that we've been lucky enough to partnership. They help us look at faith and look at globalization from every perspective and hopefully soon every part of the world. So as Ellen said, those four pillars are very important to us, so that in the classroom, it's multidisciplinary courses, so that on the campus, we bring that out through public events and through practical activities, and importantly also, not just campus and classroom, but the wider community. Research, knowledge, analysis, and problem solving for the benefit of policymakers, business leaders, and the public. So thank you very much to all at McGill for this partnership that can help us all better understand and better serve the world.
Ruth, thank you very much for your inspiring words. It is now my pleasure to introduce Mr. Jonathan Burks, the co-chair of the Faculty Advisory Board for the Faculty of Religious Studies, an alumnus of McGill with an undergraduate degree in arts. Jonathan Burks is a loyal friend and a devoted supporter of the faculty. The Burks name has been associated with the faculty for decades, and in our generation, it is our delight to cherish a strong relationship with Jonathan and his wife, Maria. Please welcome Jonathan Burks, who will introduce our principal guests.
Well, thank you, Dean Aitken, Ellen, for your very kind introduction. You continue to do the faculty in McGill proud. Je me sens honoré aujourd'hui de participer à ce lancement. Il s'agit véritablement d'un moment historique. Je répète, un moment historique pour McGill et pour sa faculté d'études religieuses. Comme vous le savez peut-être, mon arrière-grand-père, William Massey Burks, a joué un rôle dans la fondation de la faculté en 1948. D'ailleurs, les bases de la fondation ont été jetées dès 1912, lorsque quatre collèges théologiques de dénominations différentes de Montréal, qui devaient plus tard s'affilier à McGill, ont lancé une initiative collaborative d'enseignement. Despite their differences, the colleges worked together, forming the first ecumenical consortium for theological education in North America. Inspired, ironically, by a model that they'd seen in Asia and what is present-day Sri Lanka. In 1948, then, from this foundation, the faculty was established, extending the study of the world's religions far beyond Christianity and bringing all the strengths of a research university to bear upon this central arena of human life and society. I believe, and I strongly believe, that the McGill Initiative in the world's religions and globalization directly builds on the Faculty of Religious Studies' rich past, and I greatly look forward to seeing where this new partnership will take us. And now it gives me great pleasure, and indeed it is an honor, to introduce today's speaker, the Honorable Tony Blair. Mr. Blair was born in Edinburgh, Scotland in 1953. Before entering politics, indeed before entering university, he sought fame as a music promoter in London and played the guitar and sang in a rock band called Ugly Rumors. I kid you not. Alas, he would abandon those dreams in favor of an education from Oxford University, where in 1976 he graduated with an honors degree, bachelor's degree in jurisprudence. By the early 1980s, he became involved with the United Kingdom's Labour Party. And in 1983, he was elected member of the British Parliament. In 1994, Mr. Blair won the leadership of the Labour Party, which was then sitting in official opposition, and he went on to lead his party to a landslide victory in the 1997 general election, thus becoming, at the age of 43, the United Kingdom's youngest Prime Minister since 1812. And if there's anybody in the audience who wants to know who it was in 1812 who claimed that fame, I'll tell you after this meeting. His 10 years in office were filled with challenging moments and difficult dilemmas. Indeed, within a few months of his first term in office, Britain was mourning the loss of Diana, Princess of Wales. Less than a year later, Mr. Blair was involved with the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, a treaty between the British and Irish governments that significantly slowed the sectarian violence that had long gripped Northern Ireland. He also revamped important parts of public policy, introducing minimum wage and the Human Rights Act, which fully abolished the death penalty in the UK. In 2001, he watched as the United States was attacked on 9/11. And in July of 2005, he himself would face violence at home when three trains and a bus were bombed in London. Now, Mr. Blair's connection to McGill dates well before the university's partnership in the Faith Foundation. Wendy Thompson, the current director of McGill's School of Social Work, worked as his chief advisor for public service reform for 4 years earlier this decade. Mr. Blair has chronicled his time in his memoir, A Journey, My Political Life, released in September. I'm given to understand that it has already climbed to the top of a number of bestseller lists. Today, he's focusing his strong energies, his admirable energies, on a variety of efforts that address key global issues, including Africa's governance, the international government's responses to climate change, and the critical role that faith continues to play in our world today. He is an ardent champion of education, seeing in it the potential to produce ideas about religion that address current world issues. It is incontestable that the presence of his foundation on our campus will greatly enhance the reputation of the Faculty of Religious Studies, and in turn, the reputation of McGill. Today, Mr. Blair is joined by Evan Solomon, our moderator, a two-time Gemini Award-winning journalist. Mr. Solomon holds bachelor's and master's degrees in religious studies from, of course, McGill. He is the current anchor of CBC's Power and Politics with Eric Solomon, and a former co-anchor of CBC News Sunday and CBC News Sunday Night. Mr. Solomon has interviewed many high-profile figures, among them past and current prime ministers, the Dalai Lama, Kofi Annan, and Henry Kissinger. He also wrote the 2004 bestseller, Fueling the Future, How the Battle Over Energy Will Change Everything. And his byline has appeared in such newspapers as the Globe and Mail, National Post, and the Toronto Star. Now, as Dean Aitken has said, this gathering is meant to be a dialogue. so that you have the opportunity to ask questions of Mr. Blair directly. We ask that you please write your questions, indicating your name as well, on the card that was provided to you at the time of registration. And then over the course of the conversation, members of the McGill staff, who are wearing these snappy red t-shirts, will quietly collect your questions and bring them forward for Mr. Blair's kind attention. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I would ask you to join with me in very warmly welcoming the Right Honorable Tony Blair and Mr. Evan Solomon.
Great support, all the distinguished guests, some members of Parliament and former members of Parliament are here, so I'm not too far from Ottawa, so I feel right at home here. If the debate breaks out, we'll just film it and we'll mail it into the show. It is a great pleasure to be here and working with McGill again, not to be graded by McGill is a great pleasure, and to be with the Right Honorable Tony Blair is fantastic. The Religious Studies faculty team has come a long way since I was here. Certainly letting me back is a sign that the standards have not risen too high. I do want to say we'll have a dialogue of 20 minutes. If you have questions, I know, Mr. Blair, you'll take the questions, and this will be, we hope to have a robust discussion. And someone said, Mr. Blair, that what you were doing here, and they said, well, I said, well, he has the Faith Foundation, and they said, well, after ascending to the very peak of the political world, he's now decided to take on religion, just a modest goal. When one leaves this office,
When one leaves this office, Mr. Blair, how did you decide both that the Faith Foundation and Faith and Globalization Initiative would be where you wanted to direct your considerable energies, and then, of course, and we talked a bit about it, set it in a university setting?
First of all, can you hear me? Is this... No? Yes. Right, okay. Well, first of all, I'm absolutely thrilled to be here, and I'd really like to thank McGill, Heather and Ellen and Jean and Jonathan, everyone who's been involved in bringing us all together here, and it's an absolute privilege for my foundation to be involved in this. I mean, I actually set myself to work on three different things. First of all, I became the Middle East envoy for the Israel-Palestine issue. So that's quite a tough challenge, really. And then I decided, why don't we try and bring the religious face of the world together in greater understanding? So that's quite a challenge too, really. And then I decided to do some work on climate change. So this is obviously an indication of probably Napoleonic delusions rather than anything else.
Your modestness.
Yeah. but basically the reason for the foundation is absolutely simple, and it's because of what I learned as Prime Minister. I think the curious thing about today's world as a politician is that I don't think the 21st century will be marked by profound or fundamentalist questions of political ideology, but I think it could easily be about fundamental questions of religious or cultural ideology. So, you know, I've just come back from China where we signed agreement with Peking University, and China's talking about a socialist market economy today. So, essentially, if you leave aside kind of North Korea and maybe Cuba, but most countries today are going, in economic terms at any rate, to find a balance between state and market. So that kind of big 20th century debate, you know, capitalism, communism, fascism, so on, I think that is really in the past now, but everywhere I go in the world today, these issues to do with faith, with the role of religion in society, it is dominating the public debate. And in Europe today, you will get elections starting to turn on these issues in many European countries. It's a big issue in the US, I guess it's an issue here. And there is a very simple question. Does religious faith become a means of providing civilizing values to globalization and thereby be a force for progress? Or does religious faith become a badge of identity in opposition to those who aren't of your faith, in which case it will become a source of conflict and sectarianism? And that's the essential question. I think it's the dominant question of the 21st century. So, since that's what I thought I might as well try and do something about it.
It's nice of you to take on the small questions.
Yes.
You talk about how this plays out, and it is playing out in all sorts of ways, and we can get at the various dynamics, some conflicting, but there's a lot going on here. As you say, whether you're dealing in the Middle East, whether you're dealing in local politics, it's playing out. In some sense, religious issues are always dog whistle issues. In other words, you talk about a political issue, but you're really talking about values and identities and ways of seeing the world, often seen through the lens of religion. Some say that we should avoid it. There's a political correctness. Religion is a private thing, the separation of the church and state. And yet here you are bringing it not just back into the university, but, as you talked about, practically to move beyond the university. How do we use this university setting to get this dialogue back into the public, where often it's seen as too volatile to speak about?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, the basic reason for having the university program is that I think for this issue to be understood and debated properly, you need an intellectual or an academic framework for it. And there's no better place to do this than university. We need research about this. We need thinking about it. We need intellectual debate about it. Otherwise, for a policymaker and a politician, you are going to act either by instinct or according to simply whatever swirl of public opinion goes around the issue. And basically, that's what's happening at the moment. And political leaders are getting, certainly over my side of the water, getting very confused about it. So I think there's an urgent requirement for that solid, independent academic work. And the idea of the university program is to build a network of global universities in every part of the world that can work around this issue. But the other thing is this, that for this to work properly, you see, when people say, keep religion out of the public space, the problem with that, and it's very familiar to me from Northern Ireland, and when I was trying to bring about the peace process in Northern Ireland, people would often say to me, you know, this is not about Catholics and Protestants. And I would say, well, that's a pity, really, that you say that, because unfortunately a lot of the people engaged in the dispute think it is. And so you may think it shouldn't be, but actually it is. Now, if you're trying to handle the Israel-Palestine question at the moment, you know, I keep saying to people, the idea that religion is irrelevant to this is absurd. You know, it's not, it's there. And in these debates we're having in our society, religious faith is an issue. So it's in the public space. The question is not whether it's there. The question is, what is it doing when it's there? And what are the rules that guide a proper debate around it? You know, how does religious faith play a part in liberal democracy? It's a big issue. How are societies that are heavily religious, how do they find their way and evolve their way to different forms of political government? So these are the big questions. And, you know, this is a situation in which I think, you know, one of the starting points of this is that whole conventional wisdom that I grew up with when I was at university, which is that as societies become more prosperous, they will become less religious and faith will decline. This has proved to be yet another one of those great predictions that are made with immense confidence and don't actually turn out to be correct. You know, our world is not becoming less religious. Religiosity is on the increase, actually. The question is, what role is it going to play? and this is at the heart of it, and to have the academic dimension to this is essential.
But there's young students out here who are studying this. There's academics who are using it. And you're an interesting figure because you said, and you said it in your book, and you said it, that your great passion was not politics, but religion. So here you are merging issues of religious plurality and the public arena. It's absolutely essential. But I remember, you know, in those famous quotations, when you were asked about your Christianity as Prime Minister, and Alistair Campbell said, "We don't do God," right? Because it's very important. And even in the arena, that you know, we talk a lot about, you know, the conflicts going on in Afghanistan and Iraq. People say this is not a religious idea. There's nothing religious about this. It's about terror. But, of course, the other side may see it as religious, as you're talking about. So given that it seems as if one side is a slippery slope down and the other is a fiery hill, how do you negotiate that path? It seems to me, with your asbestos shoes, you've managed to do it somehow, but how do you do it? What
well,
language
difficult, isn't
do you
it,
develop?
Really? I mean, it is difficult. And, you know, I found... I mean, look, the problem we're talking about religious faith, I don't quite know what it's like in Canada, but in the UK it's very different from the US. I mean, I always remember when I was Prime Minister and I... the broadcasts of an American president often end with, in fact, they always end with, I think, "God bless America." Right. I remember I had to do some broadcast in Britain, and I wanted to end it with "God bless Britain." And this caused complete consternation. And they had some committee of civil servants formed immediately to analyze this. And I always remember sitting there saying, you know, but can't I say this? And one of them finally said to me, "Prime Minister, this is not America, you know," with that very de haute en bas British way. But, you know, so our politics was always a little different from this. But actually, the fact is, even in a nation like Britain, that in one sense is very secular, you know, religious issues are important. Now, you know, partly because of the involvement that I had in foreign policy issues after 9/11, Afghanistan, Iraq, but also, actually, Kosovo, which was the first military engagement we'd ever entered into, which was about ethnic cleansing of Muslims right on the doorstep of Europe. This issue to do with how religion impacts on policy, you know, leave aside, you know, you agree or disagree with decisions that are made, the impact of it is just vast, and it really is determinative. And let me tell you one very interesting thing that I have noticed, even in the 3 years that I've had an office in Jerusalem. And my office is in Jerusalem, is in East Jerusalem, but literally near the border between East and West Jerusalem. And I have noticed, even in those 3 years, an increased religiosity on either side of that divide. You know, so on the one side you will get very Orthodox Jewish community, on the other you will get obviously Palestinians who are predominantly Muslim, and you can just feel the religiosity of Jerusalem as the city growing. And so it seems to me inconceivable when I analyze these issues, yes, of course, into these disputes is a mass to do with politics and territorial disputes and so on. My point is very simple, though. You cannot ignore the religious dimension. And this is, incidentally, you could have no faith at all or be anti. I mean, my dad actually was a militant atheist, is a militant atheist. So, you know, you could be a militant atheist and still believe that this issue is important to understand. And my point is very simple. If you want to be a leader today in politics, in business, in civic society, you cannot be religiously illiterate. You know, that's the point. You've got to know about it. Now, you may not agree with it, you may not even like it, but you've got to know about it.
We're talking a lot about it. There's a lot of questions here, and we've got just a couple more minutes, and I'll take some questions. But the faculty of religious studies often, there's a perception, and it's wrong, because there's such a deep engagement with the world, but it's a separate thing. And what you're doing here is saying, of course, it's permeable, and it's engaged in issues of technology and health and politics and conflict and political science and the education and the environment. And it is. It touches how people approach those. Here in our country, it's played out, and I know in your country, and I keep in mind in countries like Germany, where Angela Merkel recently said multiculturalism is a failed policy. Here we talk about the niqab laws. Here we talk about reasonable accommodation. These are questions. How does Sharia law, how do we accommodate religious values when they run up against, and I'll use a term you use here in the book, our values, and you use quotation marks because it's hard to kind of define these boundaries. Yeah. They're very careful. How do we know when to say no, when this is wrong, when we can judge and not have the situational ethics where that can lead to harm to people? How do you know where to draw the line?
Well, I mean, this is the big question, isn't it? I think my view is that in order to have a cohesive society in an era of globalization, you need to recognize that people will have their different faiths, their different traditions, their different cultures. And personally, I believe that diversity is a great strength. But I think to have a cohesive society, you also need to have a common space where people share certain things and do certain things together. So, and it's in that space where, as it were, everyone puts their separate identities aside and say, here we all are together, you know, in obedience to the rule of law, in obedience to equality between men and women, in obedience to the right of people to vote in their government, right? So this common space is incredibly important. And what you've got to reach for is a balance between the diversity that is a strength and the common space where people are united together. That we had this situation in Britain where we ended up making it a requirement of citizenship that people had to be able to speak the English language. Right, because we had second generation people migrating into our country still weren't speaking English. Now, in the end, you know, some people said, well, this is an interference with their, you know, you're forcing people to do things against their will. But my belief was we couldn't be a cohesive society unless there are certain things that we share together. So these are really, really fundamentally difficult questions. And the importance of having the university engaged in this is that I feel as a policy, well, I'm a kind of practicing politician nowadays, but in a sort of different way from before. But, you know, I felt as Prime Minister that I was bereft of a whole lot of advice and assistance from the academic world in framing the intellectual debate around these issues. Because this is complicated and profound stuff about the nature of our societies. And the interesting thing, because I obviously haven't spent so much time out in the Middle East, is that precisely the same debates are going on in many Middle Eastern countries where, okay, their system of government is quite different at the moment, but that is a region in transition. The question is, where is it transiting? And one part of it may be towards peaceful coexistence, the other part won't be.
Now the question, some said, and there are theories of history, that the transition is toward a reformation. That's the kind of deterministic. Mm-hmm. That you eventually separate church and state because religious questions intrude on values that allow for the common space you're talking about. That religion becomes a private affair. And we know this, and these are the fights for relevance that these questions have, and you're dealing with. But how do you respond to those arguments? And they've become very chic, very stylish, the Richard Dawkins. I'm sure, you know, he's a very shy man. I'm sure you've never heard of his arguments. You know, the Chris Hitchens, that suggests that religion, the questions of religion outside of their argument about rationality, get in the way of what they see as reasonable progress and reasonable accommodation of different people. And people ought to move up, in their sense, toward outgrowing that. It's an old theory, but they talk about that. Yeah. How do you answer that question in terms of that movement away from it towards a public secular space?
Well, first of all, I mean, my claim is not that religious people should dictate policy, but that they should have a right to speak. I mean, so I'm not, you know, I'm not trying to make the claim that people of faith are superior to those without it. What I am trying to say is you cannot exclude people of faith from speaking in the public sphere motivated by their faith. And every time you try to do that, it always ends in disaster, because people feel as they feel if they are someone of faith because of it.
But the people of faith in the United States, here in Canada, even, they certainly have the right to speak. They're the right. But as you say, and you know better than anyone, it might not be politically expedient. But nonetheless, they certainly are invited to.
That's true. But I think that the point sometimes made by people like Dawkins is actually to say that they shouldn't. You know, and indeed, there was a prevalence of theory that said liberal democracy means that you have to conduct your debate according to principles that are publicly acceptable and publicly agreed, rather than to comprehensive doctrines of religion. So the fact is, people of religious faith do have and should have the right to speak out. But the question then is, how do you do that in a way that doesn't then end up in the other extreme, which is people of religious faith trying to dictate? And, you know, look, what I will say to those who are, you know, followers of Dawkins is that actually, if you look back on how democracy came about very much linked to the philosophical change that came about as a result of the Reformation. In other words, it was often the roots of democracy go back to people of deep religious faith who actually wanted to change the system of government that they lived under. And even today, the fact is, yes, you can point to examples of religious faith being very negative, but you can also point to examples of religious faith being immensely civilizing. 40% of the healthcare in Africa is delivered by religious institutions. You know, that is an indication of the fact that there are people of faith who do great work. I don't know about here, but back home in Britain, it is the faith community that often delivers care for the terminally ill, or the sick, or the disabled, or those who are mentally ill. And they often do this in circumstances where no one else would do it. So, you know, my view is that yes, it's true, religious faith can lead people to fanaticism and extremism, but it can also lead to great acts of sacrifice, courage, mercy, and compassion.
There's a lot of questions, so I'm going to have to keep you to parliamentary time on a Friday.
Okay. We'll do our best.
Here we go. Some from students, and I'll try to get, if I in any way mispronounce your name, blame my education. Jennifer, I'm just kidding. Jennifer Guerre, blame the CBC. It's very stylish, and you can get away with that. Jennifer Guerre, in your conversations with world leaders, does faith come up as an important topic of discussion? How candid are world leaders expressing their personal views of faith, and do religious opinions inform your political discussions?
Essentially, what I always say to people when they ask, well, to what part did faith play in your decision-making? The answer is that faith plays a part in how you think and how you feel, because it's an important part of your life. But as I always used to say to people, unfortunately, you know, you can't go into a corner and pray to God and ask him what the minimum wage should be next year, because he doesn't tell you. Now, it would be great if he did, actually, because life would be a lot simpler, and we probably wouldn't be having these debates about liberal democracy, but it's not the way it happens. So your faith informs your character, but I'm afraid it doesn't tell you the right policy answer or the wrong policy answer. Other political leaders, tend, in my experience, to be more people of faith than sometimes you might think. Does faith come up as a subject of discussion? This issue to do with interfaith really does today. In fact, the thing that was most interesting to me is when I said to my friends and people that I was going to start this foundation to do with religious faith, I mean, they thought it was a very, very curious thing to do. I remember having a conversation with Bill Clinton about 2 months after I left, and I told him I wanted to do this.
And he said to me, absolutely, immediately, he said, that is a really good idea, that needs to be done. So the people who are the practicing politicians actually know this issue is really important today, because they can feel the pressure within their own constituencies and within their own country to deal with these questions. And they find themselves often, you know, not very well schooled in doing them. So yes, religious faith and certainly the issues to do with religion in the modern world, that is part of the discussion, for sure.
I do want to just note that in an interview in 2006, you did say about your decision to go to war, you said, I think if you have faith about these things, you realize that judgment is made by other people. If you believe in God, it's made by God as well. So that informed your decisions as well.
It didn't tell me whether it was a good idea or a bad idea, I'm afraid. And that's the point. You know, it doesn't tell you the policy answer. But it does give you the strength to do what you think is right. Now, you may be wrong, of course. In terms of character, faith is important. In terms of decisions, and I know there's lots of conspiracy theories about these things, it just doesn't tell you what the right answer is. You've got to work that out based on policy.
If you study at McGill, though, you could get very close.
I'm pleased to hear that.
I should tell. Isn't that true?
It might be more helpful than if I studied at McGill before being Prime Minister.
This is from J.G. Zolm. In the West, it appears that both religious belief and opposition to such are growing. Moreover, many journalists lack the background to understand this double phenomenon. What should young journalists be doing to equip themselves to comment on the issue?
What do you think?
We're doing it.
I guess
the question is there a general, when you want to engage the public, and let's say a politician wants to, is there a sense that there's pushback, and you write about it in the media, an immediate pushback to trap someone in these somewhat politically sensitive questions?
Yes, but I mean, that's kind of part of the course, really. However, this is the important thing. The question is absolutely right about this sort of double nature of it. Because, you see, what's happening in Europe is that as a result of these issues to do with religious identity, you are getting one move towards people asserting their identity, and then you're getting a backlash against that. And this is why it's important to find a sensible common ground through this. Because otherwise, you are left with, on the one hand, a very assertive religious identity that people find quite threatening sometimes, and on the other, what you get is something that tips very quickly into phobia about a particular religion, usually Islamophobia, and, of course, potentially racism. So if you look at Europe at the moment, it's not just that this issue is causing difficulty to governments. You are getting, you know, a big right-wing, you know, far-right-wing backlash that is growing up around these issues. And then what happens to the political leaders is very, very interesting. They then end up caught between not wanting to pander to this sentiment and, on the other hand, being alarmed that if they resist the sentiment altogether, then they're kind of out of touch with public opinion. So that's exactly why you need this construct. You need to work out intellectually what is the right way of balancing this. And so, for me, you see, I mean, I'm pro-immigration, but also pro-integration. Okay? And I think you've got to balance those two things. But if you end up pro-immigration, but appearing to be indifferent towards integration, you're going to end up in quite a difficult political space. On the other hand, if you're sort of, you end up anti-immigrant as a result of these pressures, then that is, I think, a very backward and reactionary view. But, you know, the question is absolutely right. People are getting caught between that that double problem, and that's what's causing the issues.
I just want to do a follow-up. Michel Lamarche, on that point, I think this question follows. Connaissez-vous le débat québécois sur l'accommodation raisonnable? So, you know, the reasonable accommodation debate on that. And there's a follow-up on that. Why did you choose McGill for your foundation? But just on a follow-up, do you know that debate? And when you talk about it, the question from Michelle LaMarche. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's exactly the same debate we're having all over Europe. I mean, you just got to, this is nearly the Quebec example of it. And the concept of, is it reasonable accommodation? Is it, I mean, that concept is designed to try and frame a way of resolving these questions. And, you know, they have got to be resolved. And the interesting thing that I think we don't quite understand in the West is they have to be resolved because there is a large part of the rest of the world watching how we resolve this for the sake of the development of their own societies. And, you know, that's why this is, I mean, we will have universities in every part of the world in this program. Now, some of this is going to be treading in quite sensitive territory, but I think it's absolutely necessary to do it. And there is huge fascination with the interfaith concept, particularly out in the Middle East right now. By the way, why did I choose McGill? Well, it's a fantastic institution of learning. That's why I chose it. There you go.
Your political skills are not rusty one bit. Let's just say the titanium skills. There's a series of general questions, and there's a series of specific questions as I go through. Nicholas Wolfe from the UK, in light of Chancellor Merkel's comments about multiculturalism, is dead, and that... I'm not 100% sure, an approach of integration of minorities into the country has failed. What do you, Mr. Blair, feel is necessary to encourage immigration? And why has the current method failed? So if multiculturalism isn't working, clearly dialogue and the interfaith is part of it, but what else determines how this, why some things fail and why integration is the key to success?
Right. I mean, the first thing is to just repeat very briefly what I was saying before, is you've got to define this common ground that, that everybody who's a citizen shares. So that's the first way of making it working. The second way is actually to engage in the interfaith dialogue. Because the single most important thing for people of one faith is to know about the other. Because there's so many misconceptions. So when you're a Christian, and you learn that Islam reveres Jesus as a prophet, it somewhat alters, and that there are many parts of the Quran that talk about Jesus and Mary and Joseph and so on, that alters your understanding of the religion. When those people within Islam understand that debates over what the divinity of Christ is all about are debates that are immensely vibrant within the Christian faith, it gives them a completely different understanding of how Christians have come to the views that they have. So whether it's in the Abrahamic faiths or in Hinduism, Buddhism, Sikhism, you know, once you know, my very simple theory about this is the more that you know, and the less the ignorance, the less the fear. And it's often fear of what you do not know that creates these problems. And therefore, I think interfaith is a really important part of it. And that's why, you know, our high school program is about linking up schools to have cross-cultural, cross-faith exchanges between schools in different parts of the world. And it's just fascinating to hear the young people explain their faith to each other and how much they get out of that.
A student, Laura, from Religious Studies, within the context of Christianity and its endeavor to work closely with environmentalists and scientists to find a way to deliver an environmentally conscious message, is it possible that world religions can come into constructing a universal environmental message as well?
Yes, I think it is possible to do that. Indeed, there are people working on that now, today. Also, if you look at the campaign to relieve third world debt, that was very much led by religious figures. So I think, you know, this is where, as I say, faith can often play a far more positive part, but it's usually where that faith is expressed in terms of values that very often are shared, incidentally, between the faiths. rather than in terms of the individual ritual or doctrine or identity.
Catherine Young, do you see a distinction, Mr. Blair, between religion and spirituality? And if so, how might this affect the understanding of the relationship between faith and globalization?
That's a very interesting question. We should spend a long time on that. I think, let me answer it in this way. Why has religion not died out in societies that are becoming more prosperous? In other words, why, when you look at a nation like China that is becoming more prosperous, is religion actually growing in China, not diminishing? And I think that there is a basic yearning for a spiritual fulfillment that doesn't always translate itself into traditional organized religion, but nonetheless is there and very powerful amongst people. And so I think, you know, you've got to be careful how you answer this, but I think that one of the things that an interfaith dialogue does is it helps you understand that there are other paths that people believe lead them to salvation other than yours. And, you know, the most difficult question I ever get asked in the course I'm doing with students is this: how do I respect somebody of a different faith if I believe mine is the sole and only true path to salvation? How in those circumstances do I manage actually to respect them? And one of the things that you come to in the end is that even if you don't agree with someone of a different faith, you can respect their right to believe that this is an alternative path to human redemption or salvation. And in respecting that, you get quite close to respecting the fact that their spirituality is every bit as valid as your own. And I think that is quite an important understanding to come to in the modern world.
That was also a question by Allison V, you just answered it very succinctly. And so, Allison, thanks for asking that. There's two questions here that are related. One from Carmel Kilkenny. What is your position on the Islamic Conference's UN resolution combating the defamation of religions?
I am in favor of anything that diminishes disrespect, but I think we've got to be very careful about freedom of speech also. And so this is again one of the narrow lines that you tread. And we got into this over the Danish cartoons and other things, which are really, really difficult. And, you know, I'll be very honest with you. I mean, this came up at a time when I was Prime Minister. And I was grateful for the fact that the British newspapers decided, there wasn't a lot I was grateful about with the British press papers, but in this particular aspect, I was grateful that they didn't reproduce the cartoons. But on the other hand, I was shocked at the reaction to it. So we've got to treat this with care.
How do we? I mean, that's just a follow up.
Yeah.
You're a guy that was raised on Monty Python, like all of us. I mean,
yeah.
I mean it. I mean, religious faith and comedy about religious faiths is part of the culture. You treat Christianity or Judaism or religions in a way, and yet those cartoons became the third rail. And many people of religion said, wait, we live with this all the time.
Yeah.
People make sport of our religion. Why not this?
Yeah. Well, that's the problem. And, you know, this is why you need to get this framework within which you can decide these things and distinguish between a desire not to disrespect somebody, but on the other hand, to protect freedom of speech, and also to say, you know, look, this is what was very difficult, for example, when this was, because this is in a way what's creating the backlash as well. When that pastor in the US was going to burn the Quran, now, everybody from President Obama downwards came out and condemned this. And, of course, to have done it would have been completely wrong and so on. But I know what the reaction of many, many people in my country will have been to that, and in other countries too, which will have been, well, yeah, we don't agree with the pastor doing that, and he shouldn't do that. But if some imam in some far-off country decided to go and burn the Bible, we wouldn't regard it as meaning that the whole of the West disrespected, or the whole of the East disrespected our religious faith. So there's something going on here that we need to be very, very careful of, and is best surfaced and debated. That's the thing. You know, this is why I think these questions are so, that they're in part so raw, because they're not being debated properly. And they need to be debated and analyzed, and the analysis is part of the university program. They need to be surfaced as part of the school's program. So, you know, you actually need to have a conversation about, because remember when Life of Brian came out, I mean, actually it was heavily condemned by many parts of the church. And, you know, in the end, what society said was, well, we hear what you say, but, you know, it's our right to watch it if we want to watch it. Yeah. And probably today, you wouldn't have the... You know, you wouldn't. Anyway, it's quite interesting when I'm out there, in the Middle East, and the difference between what was it, the Liberation Front of Palestine. Yeah, there's a lot of that still going on. Not much has changed, really.
We have a couple minutes. I just want to get through. I'm not sure if this is a student at McGill. The name rings a bell. Belinda Stronach. Mr. Blair, women comprise more than half of the world's population but are not represented in general in leadership positions of world religions. If faith can be a force for good, how can we reconcile the faith of women who may not have enough influence?
Good question, Belinda. one of the things that the course is doing is actually raising this issue to do with faith and gender. And this, again, we need to understand, we need to analyze, we need to get out and look at what are the theological issues, either way, in respect of that as well. And these are fascinating questions, but they're very live questions for people. Now, you know, personally, you know, I'm on the, obviously, more liberal side of the argument. But again, you know, how will faith be a force for progress in circumstances where women find it difficult to take leadership positions in the main religions? Over time, this will be an issue that can't... You know, again, there's no point in trying to conceal this. It's absolutely fundamental to understanding our society. So, yeah, that will be the question. And you see, the other thing that's really interesting that I want to explore in the course of this is how faith is also evolving. You know, faith's not static. Things are evolving and changing the whole time. And that is also interesting to understand and to know. So, you know, it is fascinating that you've got a situation wherein in China you've got a fast-growing Christian religion. As I was saying, you know, you've got more practicing Protestants in China today than in England, and more practicing Catholics than in Italy. You know, it's quite interesting, and more Muslims than the whole of Europe. So, and then you've got 100 million Buddhists. So it's an interesting, you know, this is, religion is also evolving, and one of the ways it will evolve is it will have to come to terms with this issue to do with gender equality and religion.
I know there's a lot of questions. We have to wrap it up. I'll just give you one last opportunity. And I know as a graduate of the faculty, and so many people here, they go on to many different places, law, politics. It's a beginning point, and sometimes you come back to it after you go through politics, as you've done.
anything to just to say about leadership in the world as we face some enormous challenges going ahead. Just to say, because it's wonderful to have you here in Canada and specifically at McGill, any last message as this program takes root, what you hope to see when you return here, I hope often, but in the future, what you hope to see?
I essentially think that the globalization is an enormous opportunity for the world. You know, I don't actually find it frightening, and I know it changes our society and our communities greatly. But I think it's essentially a force that is unstoppable, it's driven by people, and it's changing our world. I think if I had any thought about leadership today, is that, you know, I grew up with very rigid distinctions between left and right in politics. And as I went on in politics and during my time as Prime Minister, I became, you know, it's not that I don't think these distinctions between left and right still matter, because I think they do, but I think they matter less than the politicians like to make them matter. I do think, though, in the era of globalization, the distinction between what I would call open and closed is a really, really important distinction for the future. In other words, do we look at this world and say we are open to the fact that you've got people of different faiths and cultures all mixing together? Is that something we're proud of, we feel comfortable with, and we're going to make work? Or do we actually close down in the face of it? And if you look at the debates in Europe today around immigration, nationalism, trade protection, disengagement from the world, it's all to do with people frightened and closing down in the face of globalization. And I'm absolutely convinced that instead what we should be is open to it and then analyze what is necessary to make that open attitude work in the 21st century. And getting people of different faiths to live with each other, learn from each other, and like each other is a major part of it, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Blair, and thank you for all your questions. We got to as many as we could. I now invite Jean, please come up, friend, to the man behind you.
Evan, thank you very much for hosting this question, and Mr. Blair, thank you very, very much for coming here today and enlightening us. And I'm sure that, and I'd also like to thank the audience for their very, very thoughtful and stimulating question. When I got first involved in this, I confess I did not know the extent of the debate. I think the combination of the rigor and the vigor of an academic institution and the like McGill and the other institutions that are involved with the Tony Blair Faith Foundation, together with the practical acumen of Mr. Blair and his team, will advance the discussion, advance the debate, and certainly frame what the debate should be. And it's, you know, when I thought about climate change or this, I think I had a better chance of climate change. So it's a very, very interesting and stimulating debate. I think the work being done in the Faculty of Religious Studies is critical to the importance of this initiative. On a personal basis, it gives me tremendous gratitude to be a part of it. And I'm very pleased to have a collaborator in it, and am honored and humbled to be part of the advancement of this initiative. And I hope that others will reflect on this and see the wisdom of also participating. Thank you again, Mr. Blair. Thank you, Evan. Thank you very much, members of the audience.